things in anger that we regret. The Bible is full of disastrous stories of anger and numerous warnings against anger. You know, when Jacob was dying, remember he called his 12 sons to his bedside so he could bless them. But to two of his sons, to Simeon and Levi, he said, "Cursed be your anger." Imagine hearing that from your dying dad. And he reminded them of the time when they were angry young men, how they killed some other men and hamstrung their livestock. Moses led Israel for 40 years in the desert, but the Lord refused to let him enter the promised land because of something he did in a single fit of anger. We could look at the life of King Saul and King David and King Solomon and many of the other kings of Judah and Israel, and the Bible tells us incidents of anger that had profoundly negative impacts on their reigns. Paul warns the Corinthians against quarreling, jealousy, and outbursts of anger. He tells the Ephesians, get rid of all rage and anger. And he tells the Colossians, get rid of anger, rage, malice, and filthy language. He instructs Timothy to tell the men in his congregation to lift up holy hands in prayer without anger or disputing. And James says that a man's anger does not bring about the righteous life God desires. See, time and again, the Bible presents anger as bad. But here in Mark 3, we're told that Jesus himself was angry. It's striking because this is the only place in all four Gospels where it actually says that about him. Now, there are other times when we can assume he was angry, you know, like when he made the whip out of cords and drove the money changers and their animals out of the temple and overturned their tables. I'm sure he wasn't acting like a gentleman then. Or when he called the Pharisees snakes in whitewashed tombs. But this is the only place we're actually told Jesus was angry. And what's so striking about this incident, and the reason we're studying it, is because Mark also tells us that as he looked at these men in anger, he was simultaneously grieved over them. Grieved over the hardness of their hearts. And listen, you know this. You only grieve over things you love. You only grieve over people and things you care about deeply. Boy, there's something mysterious going on here. We're trying to learn how Jesus loved. And what this incident shows is that sometimes love and anger were commingled in his heart. Sometimes his love was angry, and his anger was loving. And there are things for us to learn in this. So let's do three things this morning. Let's first ponder Jesus' anger, kind of contrast it with our own. And then let's ponder Jesus' compassion. And then let's try to put these together for ourselves and see how we might be able to learn to love like Jesus. Well, first, let's ponder Jesus' anger. You know, when we get angry over things, big things or little things, 90% of the time, it's because something we want is blocked. Okay, it's for selfish reasons. You know, when a cautious driver in front of me stops early for a yellow light, when there's obviously plenty of time for us both to make it through the intersection, I get angry. And sometimes I say, come on. And I imagine how nice it would be if I was in a tank or a bulldozer and I could just ram them right through the intersection. The more important that thing is that we want, the more important that is to us, and the bigger threat to it, the stronger and more longer lasting is our anger. Okay, if you want respect and you feel like you aren't getting it, you get angry. If you want peace and quiet and you're being bothered, you get angry. Now listen, most of the time when we get angry, if we're really honest with ourselves and if we stripped away the layers of the onion, okay, we would find that one of our idols is being threatened. Okay, our security, our approval, okay, our happiness, our reputation, that sort of thing. But Jesus got angry for a completely different reason. Let's look at the scene. He was in the synagogue, and there was a man with a withered hand. Now Luke tells us in his account that this was the man's right hand. And that's significant because it gives us some more clues that this was not something he was born with. This was an injury. He had been injured somehow, and his hand had atrophied. And the point about this being his right hand was he had lost all of his skill. I mean, perhaps he was a craftsman of some sort, and this injury had caused him to lose his livelihood. Now, one of the things we've learned about Jesus from this sermon series, if you've been with us these weeks, is that Jesus looked at people. I mean, he really noticed them. And his eyes were always drawn to the people in the most pain or the most need. Remember when he and the widow of Nain and her son. I mean, there was a crowd, may have been as many as 2,000 people. And in that milling crowd, he's like a laser focuses on the one person in the greatest pain. You know, the widow who had lost her son. So we know that Jesus immediately saw this man. And took in the whole situation. Jesus also saw his critics there in the synagogue. The Pharisees were watching him, and he knew they were going to try to use this situation to provoke a conflict over what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath, which we won't get into that, but that was a huge issue, a very divisive and potentially explosive issue there. And so they didn't see this man's hand as an opportunity for compassion or as someone in their synagogue who they could serve. They saw it as an opportunity to get an advantage over Jesus. So what Jesus did was he asked the man to stand up in front of everyone. Now, why did he do that? Well, as I just reminded you, for Jesus, love always began by looking at a person. And I think that Jesus wanted them to look at this man, to really look at him, and he was hoping that it would ignite some compassion in their hearts. And then Jesus reasoned with them. He appealed to them. Matthew tells us that Jesus asked them, if you had a sheep and it fell into a pit on the Sabbath, wouldn't you help that sheep? And here's this man standing here. He's wanting them to see, isn't this man more valuable than your sheep? Wouldn't you help him too? And then he asked them a question about God's law that we just read. He says, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? And what he's doing is the law is a reflection of the character of God. And he's wanting them to consider how God himself is good and life-affirming. And so shouldn't your stance towards this man be like God? But their response to Jesus' appeal was silence, and their hearts became hardened. They were hardened against the love of God, hardened against compassion for this man, and that's what made Jesus angry. Listen, he wasn't angry that they were disrespecting him personally or that they were trying to scheme and get advantage over him. I mean, that happens all the time through the Gospels, and Jesus never gets angry. But that they were treating this man, a man made in God's image, and more than that, a fellow synagogue member, a fellow son of Abraham, if they were just treating him as an object and as a tool for their schemes, and they wouldn't look with compassion on him. That's what made Jesus angry. You know, another thing about our anger is that we almost always overreact. Okay, we attack people verbally, sometimes physically. We get much angrier than the situation warrants. We vent. Okay, our anger is quick. We don't let it go. We nurse our hurts and keep it alive. How did Jesus express his anger? He only looked at them. Okay, he didn't explode in a verbal attack. He was restrained. In other words, Christ's anger did not control him. He controlled it. Also, in his anger, he never lost sight of what was really important. And the important thing was this crippled man and helping him. But our anger often makes us lose sight of what's really important. Someone once told me that they were at a sporting event here in Coleman years ago, and this child was injured by another player. And the father of the injured player ran on the field, ran right past his fallen son, and began shouting at the ref for not calling a foul on the other player. You see what his anger caused him to do, to miss the important thing. Well, you know, I've seen Christian parents do the same thing. When their child is slighted or treated unfairly, and instead of taking this priceless opportunity to say, I know you're hurting, and I'm angry too at how these kids have treated you or your teacher or whatever, so we need Jesus, okay? Let's trust him and pray for our enemies like he tells us to. Instead, they waste their angry energy attacking the person who they think did the wrong. What a waste. See, not Jesus. Oh, he had energy worked up from his anger, but he used that energy then to go to the person in need and to heal. Now, on the other hand, I mean, there's a flip side to this. Sometimes, depending on our personality or depending on the situation, we pretend like we aren't angry. And usually, you know, we end up acting it out in subtle ways, you know, through comments or slighting people or taking it out on innocent people. That's the other thing we appreciate. Jesus was honest. I mean, he didn't try to hide his anger for appearance sake. A man was being treated wrongly in the synagogue of all places by the religious leaders who should have been the first to show him compassion, and Jesus didn't hide his displeasure over that. Listen, we've got a lot to learn from Jesus' anger. We probably have more to learn from his compassion. So let's ponder his compassion in this situation. You know, usually when this passage is studied, the focus is on Jesus' compassion for the man with the withered hand. But that's not what we're looking at, okay? We're looking at his compassion for his enemies who are trying to trap him. Now, let me read the key phrase again. It's in verse 5. It says, he looked around at them in anger, deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. That's the New International Version. The English Standard Version says, grieved at their hardness of heart. Now, as I've already said, you only grieve over things that you love or that you care about deeply. Okay, you grieve when the people you love are hurt or when they hurt themselves. This word also has a nuance of feeling sorry for someone or feeling sympathy for them. See, it doesn't say that Jesus was grieved because they didn't listen to him. He was grieved over the condition of their hearts. It distressed him. See, he felt distress for them, that their hearts were so stubborn and hard against compassion and against all the appeals that he had made from God's word to break through that hard shell. So the very thing that moved Jesus to anger their hard hearts also moved him to grieve. I ran across this line, these sentences in a sermon from the 1800s. I just thought it was kind of eloquent. This preacher said, he looked upon those scribes and Pharisees sitting there with hatred in their eyes, and two emotions, which many suppose as incongruous as fire and water, rose together in his heart. Wrath, which fell on the evil, sorrow, which bedewed the doers of it. And that's a good way to put it. Two emotions that seem as impossible to put together as fire and water rose up simultaneously in his heart. You know, every one of us could tell of a time, I'm sure, when you felt compassion or grief for a person just overwhelm you emotionally. I was visiting someone in the hospital recently, and this woman was in such terrible pain. I haven't seen physical pain like that, I don't know if ever. And it stirred me emotionally. I almost felt physically ill for her. And every one of us could tell of a time when the same feeling of anger just wells up within us emotionally. Try to get your mind around this. For Jesus, both those emotions simultaneously occurred. I mean, how do we account for that? There's some deep theology at work here. I think it started with what Jesus knew and believed. Jesus was angry at them, truly angry, because they intentionally hardened their hearts against God and all appeals to God's love and to the value of this man. Why were their hearts hard? Because they hardened them. Could they? And that made him angry. See, these men intentionally chose this destructive, sinful path. On the other hand, Jesus grieved over them and felt sorry for them because they were controlled and blinded by their sin. They were, in a sense, victims. I mean, both those things are simultaneously true. They chose the sin willfully. They chose to harden their hearts. And at the same time, there's a sense in which they're trapped by this. Why were their hearts hard? For the same reason the man's hand was withered, because they were living in a fallen world under the curse of sin. And even though men sin willingly, they're also slaves to it, and therefore not the men and women God made them to be. And once those two truths kind of sink in, it grieves you, like Jesus. Richard Wurmbrand was a Romanian pastor, and he spent about 15 years imprisoned and tortured by the communists in his home country. This would have been in the 50s and 60s. And in his autobiography, he tells the story of a Romanian Christian named Grecu who was sentenced to be beaten to death. They would beat a prisoner in a systematic way, and then they would revive him between the beatings so that the execution would take a full week. And Wurmbrand said it was a terrible way to die. The man overseeing the beating was a communist official named Reck, R-E-C-K. And let me read you Wurmbrand's account. He says, during the beatings, Reck said something to Grecu that the communists often said to Christians. You know I am God. I have the power of life and death over you. The one who is in heaven cannot decide to keep you in life. Everything depends upon me. If I wish, you live. If I wish, you are killed. I am God. So he mocked the Christian. Brother Grecu, in his horrible situation, gave Reck a very interesting answer, which I afterward heard from Reck himself. He said, you don't know what a deep thing you have said. Every caterpillar is in reality a butterfly if it develops rightly. You've not been created to be a torturer, a man who kills. You've been created to become like God, with the life of the Godhead in your heart. Many who have been persecutors like you have come to realize, like the Apostle Paul, that it is shameful for a man to commit atrocities, that they can do much better things. So they have become partakers of the divine nature. Jesus said to the Jews of his time, ye are gods. Believe me, Mr. Reck, your real calling is to be godlike, to have the character of God, not a torturer. Now see, there's that deep theology at work. There's true anger here. You're torturing men. What a great evil you have chosen. And at the same time, there is grief and compassion. This is not how you were made. You were made to be like God. Oh, what a tragedy to see human beings so warped by hatred and sin. By the way, you might have caught the little reference in there when Wurmbrand says that he heard this story from Reck himself. You'll be encouraged to know this. Reck, the communist torturer, was converted through that conversation. And he professed his faith and, of course, lost his position. He was imprisoned, and that's where Wurmbrand heard this story as a fellow prisoner. So sometimes God does use our compassion to change people. Not always, but sometimes. Well, we've looked at Jesus' anger and his compassion, and so let's try to put these together for ourselves and apply to our lives. And let me start with a question. Do you deserve the angry look of Jesus? Yes, you do. And I do. Because all too often our hearts have been hard towards God and other people. And like the Pharisees, we've been intent on our schemes and uncompassionate. And the really sobering fact is that when Jesus returns, his angry look will be the first stroke of judgment against everyone who's unrepentant. In the book of Revelation, chapter 6, John has a vision of the second coming. And he describes, it's that passage where he describes the clouds being rolled back like a scroll. You know, there's that line in one of the hymns. And John in this vision describes all sorts of people, from the greatest to the least. He sees kings, he sees slaves. He sees rich men, he sees working men. And they're hiding from Jesus. And John hears them calling out to the mountains and the rocks, and they're saying, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb." The wrath of the Lamb, it's the very same word Mark uses in this story to describe Jesus' look at the Pharisees. It was a wrathful look that he gave them. Where did Mark get the material for his gospel? Do you know that? Where did he get this stuff? He got it from Peter. That's what the Gospel of Mark is. It's essentially Peter's memoirs. And so Mark took the remembrances of Peter that he had told him, and Mark assembled them and wrote them down and gave us his gospel. Isn't it interesting that decades after this event, one of the things that Peter remembered was the look of anger in Jesus' face? It must have been an awful look. I mean, Peter must have shivered a little bit and been thankful that he wasn't on the receiving end of that look. It made an impression on him that he never forgot. But that day in the synagogue, Jesus' look was tempered by compassion, because he didn't come to condemn the world. He came to save the world. And we're still living in an age of grace, and God is withholding his anger, and he wants all people to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. However, the day is coming when Christ will return, and on that day, the anger of his face will no longer be tempered by compassion, because the day of grace will be over. And everyone then who's unrepentant and hard-hearted would rather have mountains fall on them than to have to look at that angry face. But if you're trusting Jesus, you've been delivered from that angry look. Okay, instead, when he sees you, he will smile and he'll shout, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in little things. Enter into your master's happiness." And you'll meet him in the air, and you'll forever enjoy the goodness of his compassion and love. Now listen, I'm telling you all this because anger is the gasoline of emotions. And the only way you can possibly learn to control your anger and to temper it with compassion is to realize that you've been delivered from an even more volatile and terrible anger. You've been delivered from the wrath of the Lamb. And so how wrong it is for you to get angry when your selfish desires are blocked. And how wrong it is of you to overreact and attack people and waste the energy of your anger on that attack rather than using it for good. You're wrong because Jesus didn't treat you that way. And if you've been the recipient of such compassion and grace, how can you then not be distressed over people you meet who are the willing victims of their own hard hearts? See, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Well, we've looked at some extreme examples, I mean, in this sermon so far. I mean, Pharisees who wanted to murder Jesus. That's kind of out of our experience. A communist prison torturer. Okay, those aren't our everyday experiences, those sorts of people. You know, some of you might encounter great evil in your life like that. Most of us don't. Okay, it's more mundane interactions. you know, ordinary sins and meanness of human life. Okay, it's family members, our own children, or our spouses, or our coworkers, or maybe our children's friends or teachers, or maybe it's Christian friends in our church, you know, who do things that make us angry. And so let me give you one practical application. I'm just barely going to sketch this out, and you can kind of work it out in your own life. Maybe put it to use. When you get angry with someone, ask the Lord to give you compassion. Lord, give me compassion. And if the person is doing wrong, Lord, distress me over it. Okay, give me grief in my heart for this person and the damage that they're doing. And when God does that, and when you've let that grief and compassion sink in for a while, if there's something that still bothers you, and something you don't think is right, something this person is doing that's harming himself or other people, then speak to him about it, or to her about it. Share your concerns because you love the person, not to get something off your chest in a flash of anger. But use that energy of your anger to be honest with the person and to risk disapproval. But pray that your anger won't control you. And in that, maybe in a little way, we can learn to love like Jesus. Let's pray together.